start from the beginning. All right, so today we are discussing what is probably the densest theoretical chapter, has the most packed into it, of elements of a theory of transformation, a lot of which revolves around the problem of social reproduction rather than transformation as such. The purpose of this chapter is to provide a kind of bridge from the previous section where a lot of very specific examples of alternatives and new institutional designs are discussed, to provide a bridge between that and then the last three main chapters, which discuss different logics of strategy. And this chapter is meant to locate the problem of strategy within this larger framework of emancipatory social science. And that's why I thought it would be useful to have a general theoretical chapter of this character. So I think we should just go down the list. Nearly everyone had something to say about the active versus passive social reproduction contrast. So by my account, Rodrigo, Wes, Rudolfo, Sangyek, Maria, and Charity all, in one way or another, touched on the active versus passive social reproduction theme. What I think I'd like to do as we go down this list today is just sort of announce the topic, and then whoever within the group of people who engaged it wants to raise their particular issue, we'll just use that as the occasion for starting a general conversation on that theme. So, Rodrigo, Wes, Rodolfo, Sangyek, Maria, or Charity, the floor is open to you to raise issues around active and passive social reproduction. So don't all talk at once.
I guess I'll talk. No one's saying anything. I guess my concern reading it was just thinking about how we're conscious of our active reproduction, but how do we deal with the contradiction that even while we are actively attempting to do things, we are still in our everyday lives part of the passive reproduction of a capitalist system. So I just think that the contradiction is inherent, and how can we begin to think of ways where we're making those more subconscious decisions every day? How do we kind of align them? Strategies. Not a very exciting topic. Sorry.
Well, maybe as a prologue to that, we should first just do some clarification of the distinction between active and passive social reproduction. I'm not sure if that's the best language to make the distinction I'm trying to make. And it was clear from the interrogations that at least there was some confusion about it. I did not mean to identify active with macro and micro, and passive with micro, or active with institutions and passive with individuals. And a number of people interpreted my active and passive in that way, which isn't really how I was meaning to think about it.
So yeah, it would be good to clarify that maybe in the text a little bit, because there is, it seems to go in that direction. And also it's also your comments answered my questions largely, just about, it seems like you're talking more about intentionality than you are about, it's not the mode of social reproduction or the process of social reproduction so much as it is intentionality, right? Active social reproduction, you're talking about intentional social reproduction, right? Whether institutional or otherwise, and passive is not intentional, where the active the language I'm thinking immediately in terms of process, active modes of social reproduction versus passive, if that makes sense. So, intentional, non-intentional makes a little bit more sense to me, mm-hmm. but that could just be me. So,
but
that's it.
I think intentional decisions are still the same problem, whereas intentional decisions can act passively as well.
Right.
Like alternative agricultural systems reinforce neoliberalism mm-hmm. by allowing money to be the force that gives you choice towards organics or other things. So at the same time, as it's an intentional action, it's also passively reproducing the market system.
This contrast complements the discussion around transformation, where I make the distinction between social change as the cumulative unintended effects of action and transformation as the conscious, deliberate efforts at change. And the actual changes in the world that occur are the result of how these two come together. That is, there's all these unintentional processes of change that occur behind people's backs. Plus, we try to make the world different. And it's the intersection of those two that determines what's actually happening at POSSA.
But also, there's a problem with the distinction between change and what is not change, because social reproduction implies change. Because you don't do the same every day in your whole life, and maybe you will live your whole life within the same patterns. So I don't know if that makes sense, but why? I mean, I know the system might be the same, but well, that doesn't mean that it doesn't change or that.
Yeah,
I think the concept is done at the individual level. You might do the same thing over your whole life, but it's a form of change. You're just reproducing your condition by going to school or some. Just like.
The concept as I'm using it refers to the reproduction of the social relations. Of course, individuals' lives develop and change in all sorts of ways. So it's not a notion of there being static invariance. The idea is that the basic structure of relations is being reproduced. So when, you know, in the broadest sense, we mean the reproduction of capitalism as a social organization of production and distribution, even though capitalism also develops. And so that in the last 30 years, we've had the information technology revolution. We have quite a different kind of capitalism now in many respects than we did 30 years ago because of that. But nevertheless, the basic property relations of capitalism have been, you know, basically reproduced, although with some changes as well. So when I'm talking about reproduction, I'm meaning the reproduction of the structure, not the reproduction of each individual person's position within the structure. And above all, the concept of social reproduction is meant to be part of the theory of transformation. So it's important to keep in mind why this idea is being introduced here, what the purpose of it is. And so the starting point is we want to transform the world. We're part of a collective project of finding existing institutions as filled with harms that we want to transform one way or another. And the starting point is to understand why that's so hard. Now, the expression, why it's so hard, means that there's something which is preventing transformation. And that's what I use the word reproduction to refer to. And that's why, for me, the antinomy of reproduction is transformation. And that's why this is different from the problem of order, which is the standard sociological problem is order versus disorder. So the antinomy of social order is chaos. The antinomy of reproduction is transformation. Reproduction and social order are connected, and it's a kind of interesting sociology of sociology to kind of think through why it is that as a discipline, sociology is anchored in the problem of order. That, you know, that's the historical origins of sociology was built around the Hobbesian problem of how do you create order and avoid disintegration and chaos. Whereas I think the critical perspective from, you know, the whole family of emancipatory traditions is not so much stability versus chaos, but the reproduction of social structures versus their transformation. And then in terms of the reproduction, the contrast I was trying to get at was that partially reproduction is the result of very deliberate institutional designs and devices. So we have governments and legislatures that pass laws in order to help stabilize capitalism and make it work better. Those are deliberate institutional devices to stabilize particular relations. We have programs designed to improve the education of the poor so that they will find it easier to be integrated into the labor markets. And we do that because we know it helps stabilize social conflict. So there's lots of things that get done with the deliberate purpose of stabilizing and reproducing existing relations. And one view is that that's where all the action is. So there, you know, sort of one perspective on social reproduction is that it is primarily done through institutions whose function is reproduction. I think the base superstructure language of classical Marxism had a bit of that implication, that the superstructures were dedicated to the task of reproducing the base. That was their purpose. They were designed for that purpose. They were refined in order to improve that purpose, and very much in that kind of functional relationship. But others have argued that the real work of social reproduction occurs behind the backs of actors, without any design, just in the routines of everyday life, and the difficulty that people have of breaking out of those routines, and through both subjective and objective conditions, which essentially force people to act in ways which reproduce their own subordination. And Marx has plenty of discussions of that character as well. Commodity fetishism is not a design. It's not that any set of actors set out to create a particular form of production and exchange so as to create a fetishistic relationship between appearances and reality. That, you know, that was nobody's purpose. Nevertheless, at least Marx argued, that was an effect of the nature of those exchange relations and markets, which had the consequence of naturalizing these processes and making it harder for people to challenge them, and thus it would contribute to social reproduction.
It seems like I know very little about this general literature, but from what I know, in Marx, the discussion of things like commodity fetishism or these more subjective or atomistic elements of social reproduction are symptoms of capitalism, not so much mechanisms that perpetuate its reproduction. So that I don't know that, at least alone, that they're even sufficient conditions for capitalist reproduction. Right? That I mean, if we were to stand up and oppose major capitalist institutions and things on an active level, would passive reproduction really stop us from committing to a revolution?
Or but the passive mechanisms
stops you in the first place from doing that. Okay.
And commodity fetishism is part of the sort of theory of ideology and mystification, in which people don't. It's hard to have a clear-headed view of how capitalism works because of it.
But that's different from having a veil or that doesn't allow you to see things as they are. It's very different from a mechanism that places you in a position where you are reproducing. I mean, Marx does talk about the manner in which people's behavior reproduces the conditions of their subordination. But
well,
that's really separate from passive reproduction at some points, aren't they?
But if you think of it in the sense of you are actually, it's not just an ideology that's there, it's always built. So say you have a problem, you can either think of the problem, oh, I've got to work harder to solve, like, I don't know. If I go to school, then I'll get a better job, and I'll make more money. By doing that, you're reinforcing the legitimacy of the system that had you in a disadvantage at the first in the first place.
Sure, but that also doesn't stop you from challenging it, if you chose to. The fact that I'm at school and the fact that I need to earn a wage doesn't prevent
you can see a mechanism by which you can solve your problems within the current system.
Yes, but I think for an example like that, the more salient feature of what's going on is the manner in which your material interests are tied to the beneficence of the system as a whole, which is something else that you talked about.
But I think you could argue that it does stop people from. I think that you could say that the fact that we're all in school and not out making the revolution is part of that. Is part of that process. I think most, you know, we're, and even for the great majority of people in the world, that it's like it limits what they see as viable options for their future. It like just kind of puts a box around.
Well, I mean, the point that Ido was, the distinction you were trying to make was between a process which creates a veil, makes it hard for you to see what's going on, and something that prevents you from acting if you do see what's going on. Now, but I think that the subjective conditions for action are still part of the problem of social reproduction. A society, a structure of domination will be more stable, less easily challenged, if lots of people, because of the way their lives are organized within it, don't see it as domination. So if the veil that's produced through the ordinary practices of everyday life, which is what the commodity fetishism story is meant to give us. Now, that may or may not be a good theory of subjectivity. It's one account for how people come to think of the world as it is. But let's take it as at least suggestive. I think it would count as part of our analysis of social reproduction, explaining why we have to do a lot of work to get people to see things clearly. So we have to expend strategic energy in changing people's subjectivities, which if there wasn't a veil, we wouldn't have to do.
Doesn't that just fall under ideology?
Yeah, it's part of, but ideology is part of the process of, but the commodity fetishism does not require, the thing about commodity fetishism, it doesn't require propaganda.
Yeah.
You don't have to teach it in school.
And ideology supposes that you do?
Yeah.
Ideology is taught?
Right, because ideologies are systems of ideas that are, you know, a coherent body of knowledge that gives you a worldview. Ideologies make sense to people because of these pre-ideological experiences and understandings that they may have. So arguing about the virtues of competition and individualism makes sense in the lives of people because they experience competition and they see winners and losers. It's part of the ordinary experience of everyday life is the nature of competitive markets. They don't have to be, it doesn't have to be explained to them in a way it would if you were trying to talk to a medieval peasant about these ideas. So the reason why people absorb and listen to ideologies is because it does resonate with lived experience in various ways. But the lived experience itself can directly produce cognitive effects which either impede or facilitate social reproduction. And so that would be, and that's the argument about the passive reproduction. The passive reproduction are the effects that did not have to be planned and organized as a deliberate effort. I don't think there's any. Now this is a kind of roadmap of ideas here, the way I've laid it out. There's no presupposition in anything that I've said as to which of these is more important, which represents the biggest obstacle, strategically, which we have to confront most seriously if we're attempting to embark on social transformation. And I don't have any views on that. I have no principled reason to believe that passive reproduction is a bigger problem than active reproduction. Yeah. Sometimes one is, sometimes another is. A common argument, this is an argument that I think is very well elaborated in Joran Terborn's work on ideology, which I consider really the very best work on this kind of question. his basic argument is that it's a disrupt. He doesn't use this language, but his argument is that the dynamics of capitalism periodically disrupt the passive reproduction, and that's what creates opportunities for challenging active reproduction. So as long as passive reproduction is really working well, it traps people.
What would be an example of that?
Well, when markets are working well and people's lives are being organized by them, and they...
No, but in
crises and depressions,
yeah.
Or rapid technological change disrupt people's expectations that are generated by their own lived experience. So the subjectivities that have been formed through their lived experience are not validated by the everyday experiences they encounter because of this disruption. And that's a kind of... creates a subjective break or opening in which then you can more effectively, in his view, actively challenge, and you will be countered by more active reproduction. That is, there'll be repression, for example, would be a response to those active. So he views that the possibility of transformation really comes from breakdowns in passive reproduction. But I don't know if I'm not convinced that one should elevate that to a general thesis about the logics of reproduction or not.
I guess I'm actually less happy about the active reproduction part, especially if we're calling it intentional reproduction, for the same reasons I was sort of unhappy about the language of intentionality later. Just for, not because I have an objection to the idea that people have an intention. Have intentions, but it just...
This one's like, can you hear Todd? Is that loud enough?
Todd, you should.
No.
Todd, you should sit there, because your voice is mellifluous, but not... if we're going to move Todd to here.
And if he misbehaves more, then...
I was trying to get away because I have a cough. But.
Well, and just eat the wasabi peas in great quantity. That'll...
So I can aspirate them and then... No, I guess...
And now I'm too loud, right?
No, I just, for example, if we're talking about the role of police as active reproduction in the sense of, just as an example, the police as active reproduction in the sense of intentional reproduction, maybe it doesn't mean this, but it seems like it would mean that when the police repress riots, they are doing it for the express purpose of reproducing capitalism, as opposed to consciously, sort of in a cognitive sense, as opposed to maintaining public order or, you know, doing whatever. Or when governments adopt policies, you know, they're doing it to consciously reproduce capitalism as opposed to create conditions for economic growth.
Yeah. No, so active doesn't mean that the actors have the theoretical category of capitalist relations of domination and exploitation, which they are designed to reproduce. It doesn't mean that. It just means that that they observe the society as having a structure of social relations, and they're trying to maintain them intact rather than see them disintegrate. They may be responding to the problem of order. So it's a deliberate effort to maintain order, which means to maintain stability of the existing structure. That's different. So the effects of a policy to improve business climate, to create a good environment for investment, the way I would interpret it, that policy will have intended and unintended effects. The intended effect will be to strengthen business investment and capital accumulation and all of those sorts of things. That's the purpose of it. It may also have aspects of passive reproduction because it may reinforce the view that the only kinds of policies that are possible are policies which strengthen corporations as opposed to policies which are oriented towards improving the lives of ordinary people or something like that. So there may be all sorts of unintended effects on the general character of ideology, which weren't the purpose of the policy at all, but which nevertheless we could say would be part of the kind of passive reproduction. That is, that you have a state that only does that kind of thing. One more example of the state doing this kind of thing, one less example of the state doing alternative kinds of things. So I agree. When I say that it's intentional reproduction, I don't mean that they are working within the theoretical categories that I'm talking about. It may be that the crude distinction intentional not unintended doesn't quite capture it, because there is this ambiguity for all intentional action, exactly what is the intention. And I am making a stronger statement than it's just the intentions that happen to be in the heads of the particular policeman when I say that when the police repress a riot, that's active social reproduction. An individual policeman may be repressing a riot just because it's what he was told to do, not because he has any other intentions than following orders. Right, so
I actually think that institutionalized versus, I don't know, non-institutionalized, but more aggregate forms of reproduction versus less aggregate forms of reproduction makes more sense to me, because all of the things that are sort of in this list are sort of organized forms of collective action, basically, that facilitate social reproduction, as opposed to more or less individual or micro kinds of behaviors which facilitate social reproduction. So that seems like a better way of talking about it to me then.
But I think the organized institutions have both passive and active effects, and individual actions can have both active and passive effects. So I don't...
Right, but I'm saying get rid of the active-passive...
No, but I don't think it... But then you're losing that other distinction. That other distinction is disappearing. That is, the distinction between the consequences of actions that are part of your purposes and the consequences that come from the routines, and how important that is.
So, Eric, you want to say that both active and passive reproduction occur at all strata of society,
right,
sort of at whatever level of abstraction,
right,
or level of detail we're looking at,
right,
so, and they have both important individual and interaction effects. That's
yeah.
the idea? Okay, and that's why the distinction is there.
If it's, you know, intention in the heads of actors to reproduce, you know, capitalist relations isn't the exact right. That's not what we mean by active reproduction,
yeah.
And it's hard to figure out then exactly, like, again, what is active reproduction then? If, you know, intentionality to reproduce a social structure, you know, for one policy means, you know, trying to create, for somebody it's reproducing social order, for somebody else it's some other, you know, set of interests or set of ideas that are really different than.
Well, I guess
one.
What I would say is that there's a number of close cognate purposes. So social order and maintaining capitalist relations are very close kindred problems. Whereas serving God and sanctifying, you know, the ground on which we bury people is quite different from reproducing capitalism. And so when we say that religion is the opium of the masses, if, you know, to use Marx's formula, that religion contributes to social stability, to me that's a byproduct of the motivations of the actors. Because mostly the motivations of the actors around religious institutions are not the reproduction of structures of inequality. Now, sometimes they are, and so there are moments when religion gets deliberately, institutionally used for that purpose, and religious individuals are deliberately using religion in order to reproduce a set of relations. When religion is used in the South during the slavery to justify the enslavement of people of African descent, when religion is actually used for that purpose, it may also be part of their effort to praise the Lord, but it's certainly part of the intentionality of the actors to help stabilize slavery. You know, that was part of the purpose of it. It wasn't just a byproduct of what they were doing. But, you know, but it's also the case that religion, by getting people to accept deprivation, to regard everything as God's will, to adapt their down their preferences, their aspirations for this world because of hopes for the next, all that sort of thing. Many people who are religious people and pursuing that are not doing that in order to strengthen capitalism. And that would, I would argue, is a byproduct. The extent to which religion has the effect of stabilizing capitalism and therefore is part of the process of social reproduction is more of a passive than an active aspect of the relationship. Well, and I mean, we have these two different ways of thinking about it. There's a macro institutional versus individual action, and then there's a kind of focused purpose around a closely related set of goals versus unintended byproducts. These, I think, are two dimensions upon which one can assess the problem of social reproduction. You know, you have a 2x2 table here. I don't think all instances fall on the diagonals, which is why I think you do need the active and passive distinction. And I think the active and passive distinction has important implications for the way we think about strategic issues. And certainly I think it's capturing a distinction that has played an important role in the Marxist tradition. The dull compulsion of everyday life is the passive reproduction, you know, which is one of the sort of classic formulations in why people just go along with the way things are.
Well, but the dull compulsion of everyday life was an expression of the way in which people's material interests are tied to the system that they live in, right? Starve or be exploited.
Well, but it was also, what I interpreted dull compulsion of everyday life as just being kind of worn down by the necessities of taking care of business every day. Not so much, and not that there was a set of institutional designs put in place so as to produce those effects. As long as you have a labor process in which you have to show up for work, and if you do so, you then spend 8 or 10 hours a day doing your repetitive tasks, and then you go home tired and cook dinner and go to bed. As long as that's your daily routine, that has the byproduct of sapping your energy and your imagination for engaging in other sorts of things. As opposed to anyone sitting down and said, how can we keep these workers from causing trouble? Oh, let's have an 8-hour day and have them, now, when, you know, work in a particular way. And when you do that, then you're, to the extent that you do design it that way, that is part of it, then it's active reproduction. That there's a direct purpose to produce these consequences. Well, that's at any rate my that's let's move to the next issue which Molly and Wes raised. That is, I make some claims which may or may not be, I'm not sure how important they are for my overall argument, but I do believe them. So, as I make the claim that the...
There's both an active and passive resistance to your critique.
Why do I think that you need institutions of active reproduction? I mean, this is, why isn't it the case that passive reproduction isn't enough, sufficient to just do the job of reproducing social relations? That if passive reproduction, just you have a set of structures, and if people just live in them, that in and of itself is going to reproduce their subordination. Why isn't that enough? Well, I think it's not enough because if those institutions also impose harms on people, there will be a natural, and I acknowledge that's an essentializing idea, a natural tendency for human beings to do something about those harms unless they're blocked. And it will not be sufficient to block it, just that they are living within those relationships. So my prediction is that throughout history, if you have a system of slavery and you don't have repression to keep the slaves in place, you'll have a problem of runaway slaves. But that's a universal feature of slavery. not just of particular instances. And that's because slavery imposes harms on people. Now, of course, you can point to cases where slaves don't run away, because if they ran away, they would starve. You know, you're in a particular ecology where there's no possible way. Well, that's the fact that you have to invoke that as the explanation for why they don't run away, I think, supports my point, because it says, okay, there's a case where the repression happens to be imposed by nature, so to speak. If you have slaves on an island, you might need much less, many fewer guards, so to speak, because they can't get away. But that still, I think, supports the notion that we would predict, I would predict, I don't mean to co-opt you all into my side on this, I would predict as a really universal property of creatures that have the kind of cognitive capacities that human beings have and the kind of neuropsychology that we have. I mean, I'm talking about the material basis of what makes us human, that if you have a form of slavery that is imposing suffering on people and they can escape without sanction, they will. That's my prediction. And I'll predict it for Mesopotamia and for Alabama and for Rome. You know, I'll predict it for everywhere. And that's essentially what my natural resistance to oppression thesis says, that I don't think human beings are infinitely malleable in ways that they are so adaptive, their preferences are so adaptive to the relations in which they live, that systematic harms imposed on them will be spontaneously accepted as the natural order of things without there being special work done to make people either believe that would be the ideological side of it, or special obstacles to having them do something about it. So I'm an essentialist on the tendency for human beings to resist oppression.
I think you addressed, I think that's fine. I think you can include me in your we. My point, the initial, it sounded stronger, and you addressed this in your thing and saying, you know, well, 2 points. One, it was where there's social harms being imposed, people will seek a social solution. There's something, some sense here that appeared to say that, and then I said, well, not necessarily people will, you know, run away from an oppressive right. situation. Otherwise, well, that's a social solution, right? So you answered that question. The other question is just how, you know, are those conditions ever met? I mean, are those conditions ever going to be met where there is an absence of, sort of, how important is it to your overall argument? I mean, it's hard to imagine a world in which there is no coercion, repression, active reproduction of domination of some sort. And so is it even... Yes, is it important for the argument, and can I even imagine a world in which that was the case?
Yeah. Well, somebody invoked functional. I mean, I think you're correct in your diagnosis that I am making a functionalist argument, and it is vulnerable to the kinds of objections that people often have to functionalism. So it is indeed a functionalist argument. Mm-hmm. The fact that slavery always brings with it repression, I take as evidence that repression is needed. Whoops, did we get disconnected?
Yeah,
we're back.
Hey.
Hello. So I do think this is a functionalist argument. I take it as evidence that if you have slavery, you need repression in order to reproduce it. The fact that wherever you get slavery, you do get repression. Repression is expensive. It takes effort. It takes resources. I'm assuming that slave owners would rather just have slaves without repression. It's cheaper. You know, slave masters would be even better off from the extraction of surplus from their slaves if they didn't need to also have foreman and, you know, slave hunters and all that stuff. So my assumption is that if that's a universal feature of slavery, then it must be because somehow or other that's needed for the maintenance of slavery. So even though I can't do the experiment of seeing, well, let's see what happens if you remove the repression, that's just a thought experiment.
Pretty good guess.
Seems to be a reasonable expectation, but it is a functionalist argument.
Yeah, and I wasn't critiquing that so much as pointing out.
Yeah.
I have two questions. I mean, I'm also sympathetic to this, but just in the interest of kind of figuring it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first question is, what are the scope conditions? Because it's easy to see for slavery, more difficult to see for wage labor, say. And then the second question is, again, although I'm sympathetic to me, it is a tautology in some sense, because any apparent deviation is explained by, well, no, in fact, in that case, there is some form of social reproduction that is. So if nothing else, there is some deeply ingrained ideology which leads slaves to believe that they are inferior.
But it wouldn't be a tautology because you could check that out. That is, I would say, if some anthropologist came to me and said, here is an example of slavery with no coercion, there's nothing forces the slaves to stay in slavery, I would say, my God, that really is a challenge to my view. I bet you that there's some really deep indoctrination going on. And we could then check to see if that's true. Because it might not be true. It could be that they could freely go and they don't believe particularly that it's a good thing to be a slave, but for some reason that does violate my view about human nature, they feel that,
what's that movie?
You know, it's just really cool to be constantly harmed by these, you know, or whatever. The fact that
they're just
the fact that it seems
decide.
Increasingly a kind of silly story to imagine the alternative, that is to imagine a world in which you have slaves who are abused by slave masters, harmed, in which there's neither a cultural, ideological process nor a coercive external one in place, nor an ecological one, you know, which would be the functional equivalent. The fact that it's hard to even talk about it, to me, suggests the compelling character of the functional argument, but not that it's a tautology, because still, there are empirical implications of my thesis. That there needs to be something which actively blocks that process of severing the relationship.
How would that apply? I mean, slavery is such an extreme example for thinking about these things, but how does it apply for, like let's look at currently now in U.S. culture, you know, do you have to have a recognition of your oppression in order, you know, for it to be black, technically? Like, you know, like when you were talking, I keep thinking about, you know, my yuppie cousin who is completely aware of the effects of, like, agro food and agro business, but will still buy Starbucks coffee and will still, you know, support businesses that are corporate versus local businesses. So I don't understand how that fits into our idea of passive versus active, and because in my mind, to some degree at least, people who are making those everyday decisions, you know, where to eat, whatever, those are still turn out to be actively reproducing the capitalist system.
Well, they're actively reproducing it in the sense that they are effectively reproducing it.
Okay.
But I would say that a person who buys corporate stuff because it's convenient, it's at the big supermarkets, there's no trouble to it, and insofar as they do it, they reproduce capitalist relations. That is passive reproduction because they're going to the store because they want a cup of coffee and it's convenient. And it's the nature of capitalist organization of the marketplace that makes the convenient and less expensive thing to do to buy your commodities in such a way as to reproduce capitalism, whereas to buy commodities that reproduce other kinds of relationships, to buy from co-ops, to buy from fair trade, you know, direct relationships, all of those require a lot more effort and are a lot more difficult. That they are more difficult is probably not by design. That is, it could be. If it got to be easier and then corporate capitalism started doing things to disrupt and make harder
the alternative. They actually undermined it. Then you have a case where strategies are being adopted to block a set of alternatives that would be subversive of reproduction. You know, if every coffee drinker in the United States suddenly decided they only wanted to buy properly certified fair trade coffee that was really direct relationships between co-ops of producers and consumers, you know, that would be a threat to the corporate control over the global coffee market. I would imagine that if there was a successful social movement that was really making gains on that, there'd be a counter strategy by corporations deliberately to subvert it. Well, that would be then active reproduction, not just the passive reproduction of convenience and the way markets are organized.
But just thinking about that example, so right now a lot of corporations do sell fair trade coffee because that's how they act. That's your job as a corporation, is to maintain a market share.
Right.
You maintain a market share by, you know, oh, people are buying that coffee, I'm going to sell that coffee. And to what extent is that really different than an individual? Like, that's sort of, for me, that behavior to a corporation is similar to an individual's behavior in going to the store to buy coffee because they want coffee. You know, so it's not like they're trying to formulate the system. They do what corporations do. Same way someone going
right,
to a
so,
store.
Right, so I think my interpretation at this point is that the corporate response to the fair trade niche,
mm-hmm.
which is to have a fair trade niche within the corporate sector, not just outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
That response is just a market response. They just saw that there's a demand for this kind of coffee.
So it's passive, no?
So the extent to which that is reproducing capitalism is just a byproduct of their ordinary market behavior.
We don't know that, do we?
Well, we don't, but that's what I would expect. If they are also trying to make it tougher for just coffee, you know, that is for those niches within the niches that are trying to avoid the corporate intermediaries, if the corporate strategy is to also make it harder for these others to work, to subvert the fair trade certification process, you know, and adopting strategies of that sort, then they're trying to actively reproduce their relationship. And there may, you know, it may not be so easy empirically in a situation of change like this to really know.
But what about, I mean, because the first part of Terry's question was the same as my question before, too, about scope conditions. Like, how do you think about this in cases that do not involve slavery, where the harms are not as...
Well, take capitalism. What would be, and Argentina is a good example because we have a recent history of worker takeovers of factories. Now, in Argentina, the worker takeovers of factories occurred under crisis conditions where those factories were largely abandoned by their owners, which created an opening for workers to do something which 10 years earlier they would not have felt capable of doing, and indeed they wouldn't have been. If 10 years earlier they had occupied the factory, the police would have marched in and kicked them out, right? But in the context of crisis, the basic property rights collapsed, and so workers were able to do it. Now, if you ask the question, why could they do it under crisis conditions when they couldn't before? Part of the reason is that there was a breakdown of certain mechanisms of social reproduction that blocked their ability to act in their interests, because I think it would have been in their interest 10 years earlier, it would be in the interest of workers in general to take over their factories. It would be, and to renegotiate the relationship between CEOs and workers on the basis of workers being able to hire and fire them. But there's enforced property rights which prevent them from doing so. And I think it's true for capitalism as well, that the reason why we don't see more resistance to the harms that are created by capitalism is because there are huge impediments to struggling against those harms.
So,
and then the test for that, that's a hypothesis, as opposed to this is the best way of doing things and workers all recognize it and deny that there are harms. So an alternative hypothesis is capitalism I say capitalism imposes harms on people. Well, that's just intellectual bullshit. Ordinary people don't experience any harms from capitalism. They love it. This is that all these things that I call harms are just my intellectual take on these relationships. And that's why people don't resist.
So are you saying that the breakdown, in relation to the Argentinian case, are you saying that the breakdown in the active social reproduction, where the police did not go and the law was not put into action, that it added an impact on, or it changed or shifted the notion of passive social reproduction? Or is there kind of a...
Well, I was using that example as the counterpoint to the slavery example. So the slavery example is, I agree, an easy one. To say that it's natural for people to resist enslavement, and that without active reproduction, that is a coercive mechanism to block it, slaves would run away everywhere. That seems like an easy case. And I think it's easy for two reasons. It's easier than the capitalism case for two reasons. The nature of the harms are clearer. So I just doubt if there are slave systems in which the slaves do not experience in their daily life their condition of slavery as oppressive, in their own subjective experience. But that's part of their self-understanding of what their lives are like, is that they are slaves and that's a bad thing. That would be my general hypothesis. So the harms are more transparent and universal. And the hypothesis that they would break from that relationship unless they were prevented to is also pretty simple. Now the capitalist case, the problem is attributing the harms in question to capitalism is not transparent. And it's not transparent for a variety of reasons. And because attributing the harms is not so transparent, my natural tendency to resist is less obvious, because you don't have a natural tendency to resist if you don't think there's any harms.
But in capitalism, I think a different case is easier to prove. Let's say, if you take the historical development of capitalism, once the workers' struggle get 8 hours, it's really hard for the system to go back to 12 hours. Because, I mean, I don't know if it's a natural tendency to resist, but there is the social making of the system that makes it impossible to go back, because people would actually and did revolt.
True, we've almost achieved it in the U.S.
What?
Well, it's hard. It's not impossible.
It's hard. But then you will see the tendency to resist. Not maybe oppression, but yes, resist the backward change in the rights and things. I don't know.
Or you have to come up with better, more ingenious mechanisms to get people to work more hours, like promotion, or if you see other people who work longer getting promoted, then you work longer, and then you're going to end up achieving the same system without saying you have to work 12-hour.
I don't know, didn't they manage to do this in France recently without, I mean...
Or you could wait until so low that like a parent has to work two jobs, so they're only working 8 hours a day for each job, but it's not more than 8 hours.
I guess it just seems like it's not just a question of there being harm, but there being forms of resistance which are plausibly will alleviate those harms. So it seems like what you're saying is somewhat at odds with what you say elsewhere. I think it's like later chapters about transition troughs and all this kinds of thing, these kinds of things where the idea is that struggling to create alternatives in the near term can be detrimental in some sense to interests. I mean, so in the
but that's part of the one of the things which makes capitalism robust is transition troughs. That is, the fact that its transformation is costly is one of the things which helps stabilize it.
And what I'm saying is one of the reasons why people, why workers may not resist in capitalism is not because they don't think that there are harms, but because they don't see a way to resist in a way that will alleviate those harms in the near term. They might think that in the long term there is, but in the sort of medium, short to medium term, it may think, you know, I mean, it's like in the occupied factories, they're assuming risk that before earlier was borne by the capitalists. You know, they're opening themselves to certain kinds of potential oppression by the state in the event, you know, after the crisis, which is what happened right after the immediate crisis had passed. They tried to reach
But here, Todd, I mean, the thesis, my admittedly contentious thesis about the naturalness of resistance, which means that I'm prepared to make the prediction that when people are harmed by institutions, they will attempt to change them. That's my prediction. When people are harmed by institutions, when it makes their lives worse than they would be if the institutions were changed, people will attempt to change them. Now, when we observe, therefore, non-resistance, my hypothesis says that there must be something going on. It leads to a secondary hypothesis, and the things going on could be that it turns out to be too costly to try to change things, and that's why they don't resist, because in order to improve things, the cost would be so great as to make it not worth it. Now, if the reason why the costs are too great are because, for example, capital flight would occur, and the economy would collapse and people would starve, you know, if that's the story you tell, then it's entirely consistent with my framework. If the reason is simply that change takes time and that whenever you change anything, you're going to have a decline and that's too costly, well, then, you know, then that looks less like a distinctively social mechanism that's blocking the resistance, and it would more seriously challenge my hypothesis. So it depends upon exactly why people are not resisting as to whether or not it's just an ad hoc, you know, auxiliary explanation, or whether it's consistent with the general proposition about when we should be surprised and when not surprised. And I do think, I think it's a pretty bedrock Marxian intuition. And it's different from Weberian intuition. Marxists do believe that people resist exploitation and domination as an inherent tendency. And therefore, when they don't, you need an explanation.
What's Weber's intuition?
Anything goes. I mean, you know... As far as I can tell, there's no particular expectation that people will resist domination. They might or they might not. It depends on what their values are. It depends on what their worldview is. You know, so there's no particular expectation. Now, this is why this is bound up with the active and passive reproduction. If you believe that systems of passive reproduction can so deeply penetrate people's consciousness so that their very motivations and experience of what counts as a harm is determined by the nature of the relations in which they live, so that they don't ever experience oppression as harmful, then there would no longer be any expectation of resistance. You know, if you feel people's subjectivity is so plastic and that adaptive preferences are so powerful, that if people live under conditions of oppression, they will have a tendency to come to love being oppressed and not experience as harms, then you wouldn't have a prediction that under conditions of oppression, people would resist. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't, but there'd be no general prediction.
When you said the costs are too high for people to resist, are you also assuming that the working class or people that resist is organized and kind of collectively conscious? Like, you kind of seem to make an economic deterministic argument. I mean, perhaps I don't want to say... Well, determinist might not be the term, but like it's a...
Well, when I was just responding in that particular context about the cost being too high, I was...
What do you factor into that?
I wasn't speaking to that issue as to exactly what the nature of those costs were, whether the costs were of a purely economic character, whether they were political costs, politically imposed costs, whether it's getting arrested and put in jail. I mean, my only point was, it's this general idea that if you live under conditions which, let me make it in the simplest form. If you live under conditions in which you experience oppression as a source of harms, so this is a subset of the total set of oppressions. So I'm bracketing those oppressions which people don't even experience as oppressive. Within oppressions that people experience as oppressive, they will resist that oppression unless they're blocked from doing so. There's a whole inventory of reasons why they might be blocked from doing so. Being shot would be one, but the power of the dominant and exploiting class to punish you by destroying your conditions of livelihood would be another one.
Or not being organized might simply be another reason.
Well, yes, so if you...
I want to change things, but however I'm not, I don't have...
Right, but so why? But then the question is, why don't you get organized? So if everybody...
Too costly.
So the costs may be in the cost of getting organized, or it could be the cost of struggling if you are organized. Both of those would count as active social reproduction that blocks what I'm hypothesizing is the natural tendency for people to resist their own exploitation.
Because it could just be about the form of resistance, right? I mean, resistance doesn't necessarily imply that you're going to organize and form a union and engineer a takeover of a factory, right? I mean, it could be even...
We could start a punk rock band.
Well, no, I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, that is part of the form that of the ineffective, but nevertheless resistance that...
Well, resistance can be shirking
and
stealing from your boss and...
Right. So it doesn't mean that it's necessarily revolutionary or even, it doesn't have to be anti-capitalist resistance, right? It just has to be resistance aimed at improving your own material conditions or autonomy, where stealing from the boss could be a way of recovering autonomy, right?
Right. Are there any reactions? We've been going now for for an hour and 2 minutes and 42 seconds.
An hour?
We've been going for 1 hour, 2 minutes and 48 seconds.
Since you pushed record.
Since I pushed record, which was actually slightly after we started. So, does anyone from the far south have anything to add to this particular round of discussions?
What are you people talking about?
Did they hear us?
I agree.
That was an extremely deep... I think that reflects an extremely deep understanding of these issues on your part. Okay, let's... are there any other things around this set? Should we move on down the... So,
or take a break.
Is it time? It's 10 to 6. Well, should we take a...
10 minutes, short one.
Yeah, let's take a... There has been an expressed desire to take a short break now. So we'll take a break now and reconvene in 10 minutes, okay? Okay?
Go, Sherry, go.
Oh, see, you did it.
All right, we have regathered to continue down the list. I'm glad everybody agrees that human beings naturally resist oppression, which helps explain why we have active social reproduction. That's the kind of punchline. So the next item on the list was centered around my distinction between ideology and culture, which isn't all that central to anything in this chapter, although it's a particular perspective, particular idea that I've developed in various contexts. And Wes and Rodrigo and Santiago all, in different ways, raised issues around that theme. is the distinction I'm trying to make between the conscious and non-conscious aspects of subjectivity, is that clear? And does it seem to reasonably correspond to the ideology-culture contrast to... I guess there's some skepticism about that use of terms, so if someone wants to comment about their skepticism...
Yeah, I'm asked not if the Argentinians have any... I've been talking a lot, so...
You've been talking a lot, Wes?
Sorry.
Which, for me, right, exactly.
That should be encouraged, because whenever you say something, it is worth listening to.
Do they know that we've gone to them?
No.
You can say...
I don't know.
But my... The question refers to the link between this ideology and culture and active and passive process, and we just discussed that, and I don't think we... But my question was very simple. What's the link between ideology and culture and active and passive process? Can we think the ideology referring to active process and culture referring to passive process? That was the question.
I think there is that kind of correspondence, at least in the way that I'm using the contrast between ideology and culture. So I like to... I think a particularly clear example... I may have given this in my comments. I'm not sure. When you think about competitive individualism as an ideology, what we mean are the set of ideas that justify competitive individualism as a desirable and efficient way of organizing activities, and those ideas are deliberately produced. That is the framework of thinking that is articulated as. Competitive individualism is something which intellectuals have thought about and developed. They call it neoclassical economics, you know, and various other schemes of thought. And that's distinct from living in a culture in which people develop the actual dispositions to act in those ways. And the actual dispositions that get embodied in your ways of interacting, I think are primarily come from the reinforcements and sanctions that occur from your daily practice in the world. And it's it's reflected in the unconscious aspects of your subjectivity. So some people who believe in competitive individualism actually don't have a particularly competitive set of dispositions. And there are people who have the dispositions but don't believe in the ideas. In the feminist tradition, the the idea of consciousness raising, which is in second wave feminism, was an important part of the practice of feminist politics, the idea of consciousness raising is that you could change people's ideas about masculinity and femininity as a way of trying to transform their dispositions. But you could begin by raising their consciousness. You could intervene in these questions at the ideological level. You didn't have to begin by trying to change people's underlying unconscious dispositions.
I was wondering, where would you locate identity in this, like, the dichotomy, like, class identity, social identity in general? Because it's a conscious, I guess, conscious understanding of your group belonging or something like that. So
I think identity is a term that includes both an ideological and a cultural aspect. That is, the ideological aspect of identity are the answers to the question, who am I and who is like me? And if you ask somebody that question, they can give you an answer. So it's discursively accessible. That would be the ideological aspect of identity. The cultural aspect of identity would have to do with your sense of ease around certain kinds of people and comfort and the easiness of interaction that comes when you're in certain groups and not in others. That, you know, Bourdieu thinks of that as a kind of embodied fact. Your whole body is relaxed when you're around the people with whom you're comfortable. Where comfortable means, to a significant extent, you can predict nearly everything that they're going to do in a certain sense. You know, they're not going to insult you. What it means to greet them. You know all these kind of little subtle aspects of social interaction. Well, that's also, I think, part of identity. That would be the cultural face of identity.
So, but there, maybe cultural means more like practical rather than unconscious? Because, I mean, you know the those kind of things sometimes, but it's like a practical side, like an embodied part, which is sometimes unconscious and sometimes...
Well, by unconscious, I don't mean in a Freudian sense. I mean it's not part of your discursive understanding. So you can be at ease with certain groups of people without exactly knowing why those relationships are easy and others are difficult. That may not be the way, you know, you might not be able to give a discourse about that. So by ideological and by conscious, I just mean you can write it down, you can put it into words. And by unconscious, I mean it's embodied, it's part of your habitus, to use the Bourdieu language, dispositions.
It's tacit rather than unconscious.
Yeah, it ranges from tacit to some of it could be really unconscious. So things like senses of humor. You know, when we think of different people from different parts of the world, and some of them have a good sense of humor, and others never laugh at anything. And some people are warm and effusive, and other people are cold and reserved. I mean, those all reflect underlying dispositions, which I would argue is part of culture. And it's not that everybody who's cold and reserved has an ideology which says human beings ought to be cold and reserved. There'd be plenty of people who are cold and reserved who actually believe that it's a good thing to be warm and effusive, but their dispositions are, you know, are different from their ideologies. Lots of male feminists believe in reciprocity and nurturance, but may not be very good at it.
Lots of women may not be good at it.
Well, that's my ideology and culture shtick.
So it's some sort of set of normative principles, necessarily a part of, a necessarily component of ideology?
Yeah, I think... ideologies, I like the way Joran Terborn frames this question. He argues that ideologies can be understood as answers to three kinds of questions. Social ideologies. What is good, what is possible, and what exists. Yeah. And the what is good part of that is the normative.
Yeah.
Okay. The next item on the list, Pablo and Maria raised issues around this theme about the relationship between education and social reproduction. And
Eric, I have a question.
Sure.
Can I speak in Spanish, please?
Of course.
Okay.
Perdón, mi pregunta estaba relacionada con la relación entre ideología y Estado.
So the question was about the relationship between ideology and the state.
Oh, yeah.
Yo pensaba en una época en Argentina, en el momento del peronismo, cuando una institución
so in the Peronist period in Argentina, the unions were the institutions which generated ideology.
Y al leer el chapter, el capítulo,
we got that.
Eric hablaba de la escuela y de la familia también.
Get that.
Lo que me parecía ahora es que yo me pensaba que con la crisis en Argentina, ¿no? Con la crisis de partidos políticos y la crisis que hay en los sindicatos, yo me preguntaba ahora qué institución podría ser generadora de una ideología.
So what institutions, after the crisis of political parties and
unions,
what institutions could generate ideology? So I guess the question is...
I think ideologies get produced and transformed in all of the contexts in which people discuss and engage ideas. The ideologies are continually in the process of being both produced, reproduced, and transformed in that way. So the context in which it occurs, I assume that in Argentina, for example, in 2002, 2003, 2004, ideologies were being produced and transformed in the popular assemblies and in the occupied factories, because people didn't just do things in those settings, they talked about what they were doing. And as they tried to make sense of what they were doing, they tried to take various kinds of ideological elements which they had available and transform their interconnections. So a lot of what we mean by the production of ideology is really, and about ideological struggle, and struggles over ideology, is really about how the pieces, the ideological pieces, get packaged, get put together. There's a very good essay by Chantal Mouffe, who what she writes and with Ernesto Laclau, I find extremely hard to figure out, but she's got an extremely good essay on Gramsci's concept of ideological hegemony, which explores these issues, I think, in a very clear and interesting way. And it's particularly about how the different elements that we call ideology get packaged, get put together. So, and how a hegemonic ideology is capable of absorbing quite contradictory elements and then neutralizing them by the way they get connected to other elements. The best example of that is the way bourgeois ideology incorporated the element of democracy. Because if there's any idea which is fundamentally opposed to capitalism, it's democracy. Democracy means rule by the people. Right? What could be more anti-capitalist than the idea that people should collectively control their common fate through deliberation and popular power? That's why anti-capitalist slogans often have the character, all power to the people, right? But that's just what we mean by democracy. So democracy, before it became part of bourgeois ideology, was understood to be profoundly anti-capitalist. But nevertheless, we know it's now an integral part of the defense of capitalism. Well, that process of by which that element got incorporated into pro-capitalist ideology and then reconfigured in that incorporation by virtue of the way it's connected to all the other elements. The elements of private property, of freedom, of individual autonomy, of privacy. There's all sorts of other elements within that ideology which get connected to democracy and which tame and constrain the democratic element. Now that process of articulation, re-articulation, that occurs in all sorts of sites. And I don't know if I would be able to make a general statement as to where is the most important sites for the production and transformation or challenge to ideology. Certainly, universities are an important place where ideologies are both developed and transformed and challenged. And it's one reason why authoritarian regimes typically put very heavy restrictions on academic institutions. It's an object of repression precisely because universities are sites for the struggle over ideological configurations. I'm not sure how much that answers your concerns.
It's okay.
Just okay. Two stars.
Okay, well, education and social reproduction was another theme that was the next theme on the item. We've talked on the agenda, we've talked a little bit about it. How can education be a tool for transformation rather than reproduction? I don't know if Maria or
Pablo
wants to carry on.
Yes, I will try to formulate the question. In the text, Eric, you mentioned the school and the family as institutions which construct beliefs, dispositions, not to construct, that it play a special place in the formation of beliefs, dispositions, and so on. I think that these institutions are opposite or has contradictions in some aspects. I would like to know your opinion about that, because I think that, for instance, for children, when they come to school, they learn other points. They learn knowledge and beliefs that, in many cases, contradict the view of the world that they learn in their homes. I don't know if I was clear. Yes. Well, so that I think that school is a tool for an emancipatory project, because of that contradiction, of that opposition, I think that school may be a key tool to reach another type of society.
Yes, well, let's let other people... I'm sure other people at the seminar have thoughts on this theme, and then I'll hold off and giving my own shtick. I don't know if you know the expression, the word that we use in English, shtick. It's from Yiddish. It means my own particular way of thinking about this, about schooling. But let's see who else... Does anyone...
I'm referring to both formal and informal school. I don't know how to say.
Yeah.
Yes. Formal and informal education, or popular education. Yes.
Mm.
was going to say, I think more generally that relates to one of the questions I brought up in my response, that these are all elements you can look at as transformation, but they're also, or elements of a theory of transformation, but also they're elements of a theory of preservation. Mm-hmm. So you can use them equally in both ways, and as much as if you don't like the system you're in, you're more likely to think of them as elements for a theory of transformation. If you do like the system you're in, you're going to look at how you can be better at socially reproducing these things rather than looking at those things as something that you have to struggle against, which is a lot like the school and education through, or social reproduction through education, is it can go either way. And that's how you can build things or change things.
Which is why I didn't understand that it was set up as a dichotomy, that it's either or, because when you have a method of transformation, you of course want to use the available institutions or the available organizations to then reinforce that. So it seems inherent, and obviously school is going to be grounds for any social change, whether it's transforming it and then reproducing it.
Is that a hand up there?
Yes, Roxanne.
Roxanne.
Oh, yes. I don't agree with Pablo. Of course, education could be a tool for a transformation. I agree with this part. But a school is, especially formal school, is a state education. Voy a terminar en castellano. En general, la educación transmite la ideología del Estado. Eso lo se puede ver en la creación de la nacionalidad en Argentina, en poner a todos un delantal, en decir que son todos
argentinos. Usually the education reproduces the ideology of the state and like measures of uniformization, like everyone wears the same kind of shared schools, creating the nation.
Sí. Me gusta especialmente el ejemplo de Argentina a principios de siglo, porque era un país lleno de extranjeros y la nacionalidad era un punto importante para crear unión y separar, por ejemplo, a los extranjeros con ideas socialistas o anarquistas.
Okay, like at the beginning of the century in Argentina, with important immigrant working class, with an important immigrant working class, where the school was a way of creating the nation, excluding radical ideologies and building the national sense.
No solo usar el delantal, sino cantar el himno nacional, hacer un hincapié en la nacionalidad.
Okay, so.
Y en épocas dictatoriales, la educación también transmitía lo que el Estado quería que dijeran. Mm-hmm. Y eso pasa siempre, especialmente importa en las épocas dictatoriales, como en los 70 acá, cuando había cosas que se querían ocultar.
So, like, education as a tool of dictatorships also to impose certain kind of ideologies, which are examples of education for social reproduction.
And especially nationalist.
In nationalist.
So, I mean...
It's okay.
Okay, the way I would approach this is that schools are a site within which both ideological transmission and ideological struggle can take place. Teachers play a crucial role in this. It's not always so easy for ministries of education to subordinate teachers under a uniform rule. And there'll be lots of deviations that will occur in almost every educational system. There'll be places where teachers can impart forms of knowledge and ways of thinking and be participants in struggles over the ideological character of schooling, of course, to variable extents. So there are cases, of course, under highly authoritarian dictatorial conditions where teachers are under very strict discipline and have almost no autonomy to deviate from that.
Although even in those cases, I think if you studied very closely what goes on in classrooms, there would be plenty of instances of teachers subverting the dominant ideology in their actual micro practices within classrooms. But in more liberal context, liberal in the North American sense, I don't mean neoliberal, I mean liberal, non-authoritarian contexts, I think schooling is really contradictory, because partially what gets taught is the capacity to think and reason. Students develop a certain degree of critical autonomous intellectual skills, which makes them skeptical of formulas, skeptical of propaganda, and makes them more receptive to argument and reason, which subverts this sort of homogenizing repressive forms of ideology. On the other hand, they get taught nationalistic history, and they get taught civic responsibility and respect for existing institutions. So there's a content that gets communicated, but which may be in tension with the skills that get communicated, the intellectual skills. And that creates a context within which I think schooling can become a site of struggle over ideology, in the sense of rearticulating elements, reconfiguring the way the different pieces come together. Now, different places have different, these contexts are very different in different places. In the United States, we have an extremely fragmented, heterogeneous schooling system. In the U.S., for example, there are, in most states, it's possible for parents to decide to teach their own children at home. It's called homeschooling, and there's almost no restrictions on it.
Until last week.
Until last week?
Yeah, California decided it was actually not allowed. Like, it went... But there's people doing it, and they haven't figured out
how... It couldn't be that they've actually banned it. They must have just licensed it.
There's this thing that essentially made almost all the whole homeschooling that exists right now in California.
Really?
No longer legal.
God, I didn't see that in the news.
I can't remember all the details, but...
But in Wisconsin, there's lots of families in Madison who pull their children out of the public school system and just teach them at home. And now there's all sorts of internet schools in Wisconsin where children are taught at home, and they sign up for an internet school which can be highly tailored to the ideology of the parents. So you have Christian fundamentalist schools, but you also have organic countercultural hippie schools. You know, you have
intense sport team rivalries.
So what's characteristic in the United States, which is also symptomatic of some of the very particular institutional features of the U.S. context, is this notion of choice and the market being the general model for all social relations, including schools. So the idea is that you'll just have a lot of competition between different kinds of schools. You'll have public schools and private schools and home schools, and now virtual schools on the internet. Well, that does allow a space, on the one hand, for quite radical, democratic, egalitarian, anti-system schooling, really taken out of the authoritarian context of state provision, but also for ultra-reactionary, repressive, and conservative schooling. And it undermines, ultimately, the ability to struggle over schooling, because it's too easy for people to withdraw whenever... If ever you have a victory of a progressive sort within the public school, then just lots of kids leave the public school. Shall we move on down to number 5? This is Ricardo, Wes, and Rodrigo raise different kinds of issues around the three strategies, that is, ruptural, interstitial, and symbiotic, which we'll be discussing much more in the next 3 weeks, of course. So this particular theme is something that we can revisit as we go. But whether the issue was raised as to whether these three strategies really correspond to three goals. Is there really a distinction between strategies and goals? Does a ruptural strategy mean... is it only with the ruptural strategy that you have a revolutionary goal? Can you have an interstitial strategy for a revolutionary goal, or a symbiotic strategy for a revolutionary goal? And I argued that really there is a distinction between the goals and the strategies. The strategies really are means towards particular ends, and that it's not really the case that you, if you commit yourself to particular goals, then you necessarily have decided in advance what the strategy would have to be. I don't think there's a tight connection between these anyway.
When I brought up the problem of agents, and it's sort of related to that problem too, is who are the actors when you have when you bring about change. And part of that relates to different actors are likely to choose different strategies, I think. And that's also going to relate directly to the goals. For example, if in Wisconsin right now, there's increasing rural destabilization and increasingly temporary immigrant communities, and responses to that have been very different from hate groups to pro-immigrant, pro-migrant worker right groups that have arisen. And so I think the agents are really important if we're aiming to look at transformation that goes towards a more real utopian model. We can't take for granted that all transformation is going to be that, or that the different elements that come together will allow for, how should I say, for a broader response as opposed to a sectoral response, which can be more limiting. So I think there's sort of that piece is missing.
So there's three categories. There's the agents of change, the strategies of change, and the goals of change. And the question is, how well do these line up, or are these really independent dimensions, so that you can have a variety of different possible agents that all adopt the same strategy? So that's, I think, certainly true for interstitial strategies. You can imagine virtually any categories of agency could adopt, in principle, interstitial strategies. There's no inherent reason why that's a strategy that's available to workers as opposed to women, as opposed to an ethnic group, as opposed to a community. Interstitial strategies could be adopted by any kind of agent. Ruptural strategies may be harder to imagine any kind of agent doing it, because of the nature of the strategy may mean that you need some kind of mass agent, that you're not going to get ruptural strategies with some highly particularistic
issue.
Agent. I mean, you might get the strategy, but it won't ever succeed. The strategy as a rational strategy requires some kind of... not necessarily, I suppose. Ruptural strategies can be vanguardist with very small groups attempting ruptures.
So you assume the strategy would reflect more the group, because it's hard... I guess it's hard to envision a ruptural strategy with a very small group.
Well, unless...
A very highly well-armed, trained...
Well, if ruptural strategies succeed under conditions of regime collapse, so one view about ruptural strategies, we'll discuss this next week, but one view of ruptural strategies is the view that Theda Scotchpole argued, which is that revolutions aren't made, they happen. That is, they happen when regimes collapse, and regimes collapse for reasons other than the strategy of revolutionaries. What revolutionaries do is take advantage of the opportunity created by the collapse of a regime. But it's the collapse of the regime which is the precondition for a revolution. And that means that there are historic circumstances in which the actual revolutionary agents might be a relatively small group. It just depends upon the nature of the collapse and the...
I guess isn't ruptural also implied a certain scale of the changes, not just the conditions
right.
leading to that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I also think it's harder to see how 10, well, not let's not say 10, but like you know, a couple hundred people could go and, you know, through a ruptural change really create something drastically
is
new.
Is that more or less what happened in Soviet Russia?
I mean, the Bolsheviks were a relatively small group. I mean, they weren't 10 people, but they were.
No,
there were a few thousands of
people.
There were a few thousands of people in a population of a couple of hundred million or whatever that seized power in the context of both a collapse of the regime and a collapse of the reformist bloc that was attempting to reorganize. But then what they did was seize state power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what enabled them to have the capacity, ultimately, to embark upon a massive change. And that's different from the Chinese Revolution, of course, which really was a mass revolution over a 30-year period. It's still, of course, it's not very likely that the Chinese Revolution would have succeeded without the Second World War. You know, it's the Japanese invasion which destroyed the capacity of the existing regime to cope with those revolutionary forces.
Well, since you brought that up, like seizing the state, taking over the state, would that fit into the ruptural transformations, or would that fit into symbolism?
Well, seizing the state is the rhetoric of a ruptural transformation. Using the state is the rhetoric of a symbiotic transformation. The state is central
smashing
to both.
The state.
Yeah, well, so seizing and smashing the state usually means seizing it, smashing the old elite, and then using it. You know.
That answers my question.
Yeah. But
given this Scotch bowl, is that the pronunciation?
Yeah, say it is Scotch bowl.
So much pronunciation comes with this.
It is it's definitely Scotch. Definitely Scotch pole is how you pronounce.
Given to the degree that that thesis is true, insofar as we have let go of a theory or a prediction of endogenous collapse of capitalism, leads to a very pessimistic outlook for transformation.
Of a ruptural transformation. There's other. No.
Well, if that. So that thesis only refers to ruptural transformations?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, one could see how it would apply to other transformations as well.
Right. The Scotch Pole's book, which is States and Social Revolutions, is really about how you have an abrupt regime change which then launches a social revolution, of which the paradigmatic examples are the French, Russian, and Chinese revolutions.
Okay.
And each of those occurs in the context of a deep crisis of the ancien regime, which essentially collapses in the face of relatively weak pressure from the revolutionaries. I mean, you know, the collapse occurs for reasons other than the strength of the opposing forces, which then opens a space for this ruptural strategy.
So in the case of the Russian Revolution, what was the nature of the group that took over?
The Bolsheviks?
Yeah, like who was it?
It was a organized political party,
mm-hmm.
led by long career professional revolutionary intellectuals and with strong support among certain segments of the working class. It did have a popular base, it just was limited in numbers. So it was not the case that the vast majority of workers were Bolsheviks, but the vast majority of the popular base of the Bolsheviks were workers.
Okay.
But it was still small in terms of numbers. Strategically located in important sectors, so they're... and in a context where, there was mass mobilization taking place around social change. That was going on in the ground. The Bolsheviks were able to seize the initiative because the Mensheviks, which the word means majority, Menshevik,
and Bolsheviks meant minority.
No, other way around.
The Bolsheviks were the minority.
Okay, but it means the big party.
No, the big party was the social democracy, and these were two factions.
And the Bolsheviks were the minority group within the smaller group. Whatever the words mean, they were the smaller group. But the Mensheviks were basically holding back the what was in fact an insurrectionary but diffused movement among the masses of people who were not necessarily Bolsheviks, but which were activated by the chaos and by the situation, seizing factories, doing all sorts of things. And so the Bolsheviks were able to succeed so rapidly, I think, because they tapped in better than the Mensheviks to what was the energy at the base.
Okay. Well, and I guess that was one of the things I think that with regards to, if you have really specific sectoral problems, which is what is generally the tendency for people to organize around, is it necessary to have that, an elite of some sort to tie that specific complaint to broader structures to then allow, create support for larger transformation?
So by sectoral, you mean something like the food system as a sectoral concern?
Or yeah, or even smaller, like a union, because like union, like different unions or things like that, different workers' rights, different...
I mean, it's been a classic thesis, not just of Marxists, but of, I think, activists, many currents of political actors, that political parties are the vehicle for tying together the particularistic concerns of given sectors or groups into an overall project. And part of what political parties try to do is to convince otherwise quite disparate groups of people who have their own grievances and their own visions that they really are part of a broader problem with a broader solution. Certainly that's what revolutionary parties have tried to do in their, you know, ideological battle. So revolutionary socialists have talked to small farmers and artisans and factory workers and teachers and said, you all are suffering under the existing structure, you all have complaints for particular things, join with us and we'll create an alternative within which all of your needs can be addressed. And that's what political parties do, but it's also what right-wing political parties do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the distinctive feature of political parties as opposed to social movements is that they virtually always couch their agenda and their projects in universalistic terms. It's part of the nature of political competition around the state, whether it be under democratic or non-democratic conditions. I mean, fascist parties, you know, Franco would use, in Spain, use universalistic appeals.
But I think that's increasingly the case for transnational social movements, in order to bridge boundaries between like what are really disparate groups that could possibly have the same agenda.
Right.
You end up, same thing, you couch sort of the terms of the debate in a broader, less, more diffuse set of principles.
I mean, it'd be interesting how far that can be stretched in transnational, how heterogeneous are the interests which they're trying to weave together.
And they seem quite, when you look at them, they often seem quite, you can agree on principles of social justice or environmental sustainability but those are really things that have...
You have common enemies.
Sometimes they're in the same network.
I mean, environmental concerns and social justice concerns have had extremely uneasy connections between them. It's not been so easy to put those together. The organic food movement rarely worries much about farm workers.
But it's still implicit in their platforms.
But not in their actual practices.
No.
And in ways which actually sometimes creates alliances between organic farmers and conventional farmers against farm workers. I mean, in California, that's been a chronic problem.
Although what's interesting is that, at least in, for example, in Mexico, efforts to sort of diffuse organic production methods were tied to sort of, were actually disseminated, those methods were disseminated by NGOs, which were sort of development NGOs, and especially sort of indigenous kinds of organizations that were trying to promote indigenous rights. So outside the U.S., it might be actually a little bit different.
So the NGOs that were pushing organic agriculture were doing so in conjunction with indigenous rights?
Yeah, I mean, this is my understanding. I've just learned about this, but I mean, there was no sort of internal demand for organic produce in Mexico. It's mostly for the export market to the U.S. A lot of it, I assume, is called coffee, but apparently, from what I can tell, it was NGOs which are presumably funded by the U.S. or wherever, that were trying to get people to grow using organic methods, and especially sort of in indigenous areas, again, for the export market. So it was much more sort of in tune with, in theory, and with the labor aspect. In theory.
Ricardo or Rodrigo, do you have any thoughts on these, on this cluster of themes, since you were your interrogations concerned them?
I keep on having doubts about this thing of strategies, that these three are called as different strategies. I guess I when we we will deepen in these things next week. This could be more clearly to me.
Okay.
But in this level, it's very abstract, and I guess I can't get very clearly what you're trying to get to say with these three strategies.
Well, I hope it does get clearer as we as we move on, of course, towards this last cluster of chapters in the book. What I mean by strategic logics, though I'm trying to specify the means of change rather than the goals. The goals are moving beyond capitalism in the direction of a democratic egalitarian alternative anchored in social power. So the institutional design of which remains partial and incomplete. That's the argument of the previous section, that is, that we don't have a complete design of an alternative which we can postulate in advance. We can only postulate principles and then illustrate different institutional proposals that embody, in one way or another, aspects of those principles. That's the socialist compass and the way I propose we think about alternatives. Then the strategies are different ways of imagining the political mobilization and transformation process by which you would accomplish those alternatives. My claim, then, is that you logically, perhaps not sociologically, but logically, could have a ruptural strategy for a democratic egalitarian alternative, an interstitial strategy for a radical democratic egalitarian alternative, and a symbiotic strategy. Each of these could be, in principle, effective strategies for accomplishing that end.
whether in practice all three strategies could accomplish the same end is another question. That's part of the debate about strategy. The classic debate between reformists and revolutionaries, I think, takes two forms. One argument is reformists don't even really want socialism. They're actually sellouts. They actually only want a nicer capitalism. And when they say they want socialism, they're being dishonest. Whereas revolutionaries really want socialism. So that's one version of the debate as to what they actually want to achieve. But another version is, no, left-wing social democrats really want to go beyond capitalism and create a socialist alternative, as do revolutionaries. But they have different understandings of what the steps between here and there are. And the reformists believe that it's possible to get to that destination through a set of smaller incremental steps, which have the effect of undermining the system of reproduction and creating these new possibilities. The revolutionaries say that's an illusion, it'll never happen. Those incremental steps will always be stopped and reversed. But that's a debate over strategy, not a debate over goals. I'm trying to frame this as a debate over strategy, not goals. I'm assuming that there's among social democrats who are the champions of the symbiotic strategy and anarchists who are the champions of the interstitial strategies, there are at least some left-wing social anarchists who have a democratic egalitarian vision of an alternative. And there are at least some left-wing social democrats who have a democratic egalitarian vision of social power in the alternative. And that where they differ is in their conception of the strategies, which is what then this is trying to articulate. What the last three chapters try to do is to give as clear and systematic an account of what the nature of those strategies really amounts to and what are the underlying assumptions for them to be strategies for those goals. So in each chapter we will see a presentation of that logic and, in fact, an exposition of skepticism. I'm in the position of arguing on the one hand for these goals of socially empowered democratic egalitarian alternative, laying out these three logics of strategy and expressing skepticism about each of the three logics, because it's easy to show why each of them is not likely to be successful. And then my view is that each of them taken separately is unlikely to be successful, and that any future possibility of real fundamental transformation has to figure out ways of combining them, because each of the strategies has certain clear limitations, which it's possible that complementary strategies might in fact help neutralize the disadvantages of any one. I'm sometimes accused of being a wishy-washy liberal because I want every position to be legitimate. You know, I just let a thousand flowers bloom, let anarchists and social democrats and revolutionary socialists all work together in harmony to create a better world. Right? That's my fantasy here. So,
Barack Obama.
Not at all, like bro.
Except in this case, it's Republicans and Democrats.
So we have a few minutes left. We can't get through all of these. So let me just open it up and say, if anybody would like to raise any of the remaining thematic issues, we kind of went through the first five. So there's five more clusters of themes that different people raise. So anyone who wants to raise one, that will probably round off the session today. It's your chance if your key issue hasn't yet been addressed.
I think
think I'd like to raise, I think it's Ito's.
I was thinking I wanted to read Ito's too.
Okay. And it was sort of my comment too, which got in late, so.
It was included in the final version of the.
Yeah, no, yeah. And I mean, I guess just my sense is, and this is sort of, maybe this comment comes in the form of a request for more or something in this chapter, even though it's already the longest chapter, I think, but. You know, my sense is that most of the chapter is about social reproduction, and then, you know, then there's the section on contradictions, which is good, I thought.
It's okay.
But I was really unsatisfied by the section on dynamics and trajectory of unintended social change, and I don't have a solution for that, but it kind of is unsatisfying in the sense that, you know, the chapter is called Elements of a Theory of Transformation, and then it's kind of all about reproduction, which
well,
is understandable.
Of course, the last three, I mean, the next three chapters are
right, but that could have been part of this chapter,
but
that comes under strategies of transformation, and I guess what I want to know is not the strategies so much as the conditions for transformation. And so, you know, one of my requests was, well, maybe the social movements literature has something to tell us. And your response was, no, not really. It's not that good. Sure, it's probably true. I mean, the other part of that was not just social movements per se, but either the literature on revolutions or just social change more generally. What kinds of conditions are
so,
more?
Yeah,
I mean,
so
you just kind of want to know more about what could actually make any of this work. And maybe we just don't know, but it's sort of unsatisfying not to get that in a chapter about transformation.
So, in terms of the conditions for transformation, as you will have noticed from the book, there's no concluding chapter yet. So, part of what I'm planning for the concluding chapter is precisely engaging that question. That is saying, okay, now we've done all this stuff, we've looked at it all, you have all these pieces in place, under what conditions is it possible that these strategies would be able to, in fact, push us along the socialist compass towards transformations beyond capitalism? And I was going to attempt to say whatever I might be able to say. I haven't written that because I find it hard to do is to say anything that's very interesting on the topic. So there's some obvious points, and I suppose even though they're obvious, it's worth saying. One obvious point is that breakthroughs towards new institutional configurations, whether they be through new symbiotic configurations, like the social democratic breakthroughs of the middle of the 20th century, or ruptural breakthroughs, or even tipping point interstitial breakthroughs. You know, the interstitial logic of transformation works because of tipping point kinds of thinking. So one sort of obvious point is that those sorts of things are most likely to happen under conditions of crisis, particularly prolonged crisis. That is, crisis conditions that don't get resolved so quickly that new institutions can't consolidate, right? So that's a kind of obvious point. It's the sort of backpedaled version of the doom of capitalism point. That is, the doom of capitalism, the destiny of capitalism theory was meant to give us confidence that you'd have a long enough crisis at some point. The episodic, uncertain timing, but certain eventuality of crises. That is, what I'm prepared to predict with very high level of confidence is that there will be periodic crises of capitalism. That I can predict. But what I can't predict is that they'll be long and protracted, because I don't know, or that they will have a tendency to intensify. What the theory of the future gave us was those two elements, that they will eventually be long and protracted, and they will intensify. And if they're long and protracted, that's what gives you the time to consolidate new institutions. It's kind of like in the Argentinian takeover of factories. In a way, the crisis didn't last quite long enough, perhaps. If it had gone on for another 3 or 4 years at its intense level, the number of factories that could have been taken over and their capacity to actually consolidate new forms of organization and perhaps create this new formula, state ownership, workers' control, which is a nice formula. You know, what it means is another question, but it's a nice idea because it does imply something going more beyond the existing. Well, maybe the crisis just wasn't long enough. Not a question of how deep it is, but just how long it is. Because real time is needed for consolidation of new institutions. Well, that's what I can't make any prediction. That's where my implications of a lack of the theory of the future is. Simply not having confidence that there will be crises of sufficiently protracted character to create those windows of opportunity. Now, what I do have confidence is that there will be windows of opportunity, and therefore moments within which different combinations of these strategies have greater effectivity, greater mobilizing capacity, greater institution building capacity. And that my view is the best we can hope for is having our social movements, political parties, collective organizations sufficiently aware of the range of institutional possibilities and programs that are worth doing, that some of them you do under unfavorable conditions. So the interstitial strategies are often strategies that you can always pursue even under very unfavorable conditions. Under somewhat more favorable conditions, symbiotic strategies become possible. That is, there may be something short of a prolonged crisis in which there are still prolonged problem solving needing to be done, which can elicit these socially empowered forms. And then maybe or maybe not, the ruptural strategies will have their moments of windows of opportunity. Something along those lines is what my conclusion will
be. Maybe next week we'll have the answer. In Argentina.
That's our homework for the week.
Well, it's 7 o'clock. Is it 9 o'clock in Buenos Aires now? We're a two-hour difference. So I think we should call it a night for this week.
What are we doing about the thematics?
Everyone should email me their thematic sketches for their papers. I receive quite a few. As I've told one or two people, the main purpose of having the thematic sketch is just to be sure that you are doing things as opposed to waiting. So the main purpose is just a benchmark that you've moved one step further along the process than you would otherwise perhaps have done. I would rather get the thematic sketch a few days late and have it be more coherent than getting it a few days earlier and having it be a mess. So those of you who don't have it, this is almost a direct quote from some unnamed person who asked me if it was okay to be delayed a few days. So if you haven't gotten them to me, don't worry about it. Just get it to me sometime in the next, you know, few days or a week. All I care about is that progress is being made so that we actually will have papers by the time of the conference.
Well, I have the papers are due before the conference.
Well, you have
to revise them.
Absolutely, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, the papers are due before the conference because they're to be presented at the conference.
Okay.
Are they going to be discussed on some things or?
It depends if we get. I'm not sure yet. What I would like to let me say. What I would like to do. The ideal would be for me to get all of the papers at least 3 or 4 days before the conference. So what I'd like to do is duplicate them all and have a packet. So people actually have, you know, everybody comes, we'll have a set of the papers for everybody at the conference. Because first of all, it makes it more like a professional conference, but I think it's also, it's nice to have the papers to be able to look through them as they're being presented. Now I know there's a peculiar set of problems with the Argentine papers because of language and translation needs and so on. So I'm not sure exactly how to finesse that. the papers, the verbal presentations at the conference have to be, I think, in English, or at least I hope. If we have to do translation, that'll make it more complicated, obviously. So I'd like them to be presented in English. But I understand that writing them in English may not be the optimal way of getting a good, clear paper written. So it's okay with me if you write them initially in Spanish, so long as you prepare an English presentation.
Okay.
But then we will need, if you want me actually to read them, we'll have to work out a way after the conference to get them translated into English.
Or French.
Or French, I suppose, but we might as well do it in English.
Eric, will you expect us to do PowerPoint presentations, or are we going to try to keep it more...
The question that was asked was about PowerPoint presentations. I don't expect PowerPoint, but we will have the facility for them.
Okay.
And of course there's going to be lots of informal discussion on this weekend. It's not going to be a sober, serious, you know, grim-faced professional conference. I would actually like the panels to have a pretty professional quality to them, because I want... Part of the purpose of the mini-conference is practice. Mm-hmm. For, you know, for the students in the seminar to really have a dry run in a very friendly setting of standing up and doing a 20-minute presentation of what is probably an hour's worth of material, but is most of these papers, to fully present. So you have to learn how to distill it, and then to give it in this more formal manner. I think typically PowerPoints get used too much.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be really a distraction, because the audience is reading stuff, and then the talk isn't quite tracking. So I'm not by any means saying you should do it, but a good use of PowerPoint is, PowerPoints have become pretty much the norm for these things. And to have a PowerPoint that just has the basic outline of the talk, and so people can see where you're going, is fine. Sometimes if you're giving some extended quotes from some sources, it's nice to have the PowerPoint of something that you're going to actually read anyway. It helps the audience. In the 3 weeks before the conference, when the seminar isn't meeting, and this applies to you as well in Argentina, I'd be happy to discuss, of course, with anyone, anything about their papers in that period. Including if you prepare PowerPoints and you want to go over them with me beforehand, absolutely. That's part of the point of having the three-week period without the class, is so that people can work intensively on the papers, but also intensively with me about their papers.
What are the dates of the conference?
The conference starts...
It's on the website.
It starts
what
on
conference?
Friday.
The conference.
We're going somewhere?
So it starts on Friday the 9th and it ends Sunday the 11th.
Where is it?
Some people will stay a few more days, though, if you want to stay. No?
Up there at the conference site? You can't. I don't think you'll be able to stay at the conference site itself, but there's plenty of places right there you can stay if you want to stay at in the Dells.
Yeah.
Okay.
We are going to have a Friday evening session, so the actual conference will start at 7.
Mm.
The conference center will have, if I can negotiate it with them, I'm not sure. In principle, we can have dinner there on Friday night. The problem is that they have their evening meals extremely early, and it's rural Wisconsin. They believe the dinner is at 5:30. They actually wanted it at 5, and I just don't think that's realistic on Friday. So. Or for that matter, on Saturday. What we've done on previous years is we've had potlucks. They have refrigerators there. People have brought stuff, and then we've had camp stoves to heat up things.
So we'll do that for Saturday. We'll have for Saturday evening. We're going to have a party with. For Friday, we might just order pizza from the town, which is, you know, you can just order a bunch of pizzas and have a pizza dinner rather than have the camp, the conference center provide dinner. So they'll do breakfast and lunches on Saturday and Sunday. Mm-hmm. On Sunday, I think we'll need the full afternoon in order to. This is in order to also have some recreational time for some canoeing on Saturday and enjoying the place. If when we arrive there on Friday night it's going to be storming and raining all weekend, then we might cancel the canoeing and then we might finish a little earlier on Sunday. But okay. For the, by the way, for the, I may have, I think I've said this, for the Madison people, it's absolutely fine to bring friends and partners, and, you know, this is an open conference, so not everybody, it's not restricted to people who have been active participants in the activities.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'd like this to be, to function as a kind of retreat and discussion venue for students on the left and social movement oriented students and so forth. So I'm going to give an announcement and make it available to the department as a whole, but more importantly, friends and family. All right?
I love it.
Mm-hmm. See you next week.
I think
they
fail.
Are you concerned about
fail?
I'm very concerned about
coffee.
I just
one last question. If the paper's not due the 9th, it's because I have to plan to go somewhere shortly after then. When would the final deadline for the paper be?
Tomorrow.
We could also just like, is there a school?
Bring
I'm. Oops, let me turn this off.